Once again, everybody, it is Steen with Steen on Sports, and I have another interview with some doctors from Des Moines Orthopedic, DMOS, as someone who's had a bunch of their kids go through. I asked them if it's okay if I called it DMOS, so I hope that's okay. Dr. Leah Gannell is my guest today. Doctor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I thank you for coming on. We talked a little bit before we came on just to make sure that, you know, I'm not a full-time engineer here with radio, so making sure everything was okay. You have a very interesting story, and I want to get to all the ankle and all that stuff, but I want to talk about your story a little bit too. When you first went to school, what did you want to go to school for?
Actually, coming out of high school, I initially did think I wanted to go into medicine, but nobody in my family did anything along those lines. I grew up in Michigan. Everybody in Michigan, not everybody, but a very large majority of people work for one of the auto industries. And so everybody in my family worked for GM or Ford. And I wasn't sure if I'd be able to get into medicine because I just knew it was hard to do. So I did engineering for my undergraduate. And after finishing my undergraduate degree, I liked it quite a bit. So I went straight to work for Northrop Grumman as a materials engineer doing semiconductor work for one of the defense contractors for a little while before going back to school again.
That is fascinating. And what does one engineer do? What was the job that you had there?
So materials engineering can cover essentially anything that you want it to, engineering wise, because it's the substrate for essentially everything else that, you know, is being built. So it's a lot of materials properties. And specifically, my job was in semiconductor processing for rad hardened memory systems for satellites. And they also did some of the radar systems for like the Apache Longbow helicopters and like F-16s and things like that.
That is, once again, it is fascinating. I have to say this, that I watched a little bit of a podcast that she did, and I was fascinated by that. But lo and behold, you did get into medicine. How did that get started?
I really apparently did not do very well working just strictly as an engineer. I found it difficult to sit and do meetings all day and just, you know, work projects, seated at a desk. And so I started just taking classes again, even the first year working. And then I actually applied for graduate school and did graduate research in basic sciences and pathology, and then applied to medical school while I was doing graduate research as well. So I actually did a longstanding time at University of Rochester for both medical and graduate school.
That is incredible. And once again, I just wanted to hear that because I'm listening to this podcast and it's like, okay. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, she can't have, if she's doing all this, she can't have anything else in her life that could keep her busy. And lo and behold, you do. You rescue horses.
I do. I have a few dozen of them in our rescue. So I went to practice initially down in Texas, and we ended up with a good-sized piece of land down there and a lot of horses in need, kind of on their way to Mexico down in that area. And we very quickly accumulated in the 40s as far as the number of horses, but we've been working, you know, for the last several years on getting them retrained, rehabbed, and adopted out.
What led you to come to Iowa and end up at Des Moines Orthopedic?
After being down in Texas, it turned out I was not a very good Texan. I don't really like the heat or the rattlesnakes. So being from Michigan, I did want to move back where the weather went through all four seasons. We had grass again. I was in West Texas where it was a lot of blowing dirt. So instead up here, we have blowing wind, but we actually have green pastures, which is very nice, especially when you have horses. And it puts me much closer to my family back in Michigan as well.
You started, or you currently are foot and ankle and lower extremity. Is that what, was that kind of where you wanted to go, or was that, did you have another reason for that?
I specifically chose foot and ankle. I'm partially a glutton for punishment, or maybe it's part of the engineer in me. But the foot is relatively complex. A lot of people don't like to do a lot of the stuff with complex foot reconstruction, but it's very mechanical to me. And so it made a lot of sense. No case or reconstruction is exactly the same as another, you know, as the one before it. So I like the challenge. I like hands-on activity. The reason I didn't do well in engineering for a job was I was doing too much seated work and not enough hands-on. Whereas with orthopedic surgery, it's very hands-on. It still incorporates a lot of both materials, just because of implants that we use, selections, as well as mechanical sense with the biomechanics of the body. So I love that aspect of it. And then I also take a lot of trauma calls. So I do a lot of lower extremity trauma in addition to the reconstructive foot and ankle work.
Okay, so we'll get to the trauma because I'm really interested about that. One of the most intriguing things about DMOS is its work with some of the high schools and some of the colleges in the surrounding area. I, for one, have had all three of my sons have been in there for ankle injuries, turning an ankle. Just explain to people, you know, the severities in ankle sprains, how they happen, what actually is happening. Because, you know, going through all of that and seeing all of that, I still don't know exactly what an ankle sprain is.
So an ankle sprain in the simplest terms is a strain or a tear in the ligaments around the ankle. And most commonly, it's more of an inversion type injury, or you turn your ankle, you know, to the inside, you land on the outside of your foot. But you can also come down and get more of a high ankle sprain where there's a little bit more of where your foot is pointed down or plantar flexed, as well as inverted. And you can get a little bit more injury through, you know, the high ankle sprain. And some of that can disrupt some of the ligaments that extends between the two bones, the tibia and the fibula within your leg. And so some of those can actually have more acute surgery if you have significant enough disruption. But the majority of the other ones, from the severity, you know, from the straining of it to complete tears, they kind of go from a grade one to a grade four as far as the amount of tearing. But the majority are still able to just be rehabbed and not require surgery. That being said, some people injure their ankles multiple times or have a foot shape that makes them more prone to it. And occasionally you do have to go back in and tighten some of those ligaments up if they do not heal as tightly after a higher grade sprain. But the majority, we can get you back up and going with significant amount of rehab.
And that brings in your material engineering to kind of full circle to help you in doing stuff like that as well.
Our physical therapists are honestly a huge help when it comes to a lot of the ankle sprains, because that really makes a huge difference as far as them getting back to play and getting the strength back to get those dynamic stabilizers. So your ankles, you know, you have your dynamic and your static stabilizers. So when you sprain your ankle, you're disrupting those static stabilizers, those ligaments. And then if you can get that dynamic strength back, then you're a little less dependent on those ligaments and a little less likely to disrupt those with subsequent injuries. So without help from our therapists and the patients, you know, participating, obviously, getting themselves back up to functional strength, we couldn't do it.
That is and
on our own kind of thing.
Once again, that is just after listening to you and seeing you, that is so you that, you know, you're bringing in everybody else and it's a team effort, and I get that. So I want to take care of one myth. It was a myth that I assume my dad did to me. I probably did it too much to my sons. But if you have an ankle sprain and you're out on the basketball court or you're on the baseball field or on the football field, you come to the sidelines and everybody's yelling at you, just tighten your shoe up and go back out. Not a good idea.
Tightening the shoe up doesn't do a whole lot for stabilization of the ankle itself.
It's called bad parenting, really. So I announced that on the radio. So
it's okay. I played soccer all the way through college too, or played less in college, sat on the bench a lot in college, but played up into college. And, you know, you get back out and you play on it. But the problem is acutely when it happens, if you don't have the strength and you're getting, you know, the pain response, which causes a reflex to essentially withdraw, like you're touching fire, you're going to, it's going to give out, it's going to roll, and you're going to actually re-injure yourself and potentially take something that might be a lower grade, you know, sprain and make it worse. Once you get that swelling down, the pain's controlled, as you start getting your strength back up, you can absolutely start returning, you know, to some play, but you just need to make sure that you have the strength to not injure yourself further. You at least need the ankle supported.
Yeah, and that's, and just so everybody also knows, that that is now why I'm assuming that as a 56-year-old, when I'm walking around, when I get up in the morning and my ankles are cracking all the way as I move around the house, that would be because I probably didn't let my, let everything heal correctly.
It depends. It depends on what's popping and cracking. Sometimes it's just a little bit of air in the joint, essentially. We don't, you know, we all kind of pop and crack.
I think so.
I'm not going to say that's just.
The older you get, the more you do. Once again, we're talking to Dr. Leah Gunnell. She is a foot and ankle and lower extremity doctor at Des Moines Orthopedic. If you, I listened in the podcast, and you know, we've talked about light sprains. What happens when it's more serious than that? What is the kind of, if a person comes down and maybe turns it the other way or really hurts it, can't put weight on it, what is kind of the way that you take care of that? And what's the time frame normally for, let's say, a high school student athlete?
So if you have a higher grade where you actually have complete tearing, a lot of times they'll still heal on their own without needing surgical intervention. You can sometimes get some tendon tearing as well. But if there is some instability or we feel some laxity on exam, then we are more likely to, you know, give you a little period of downtime within a boot for a few weeks before we begin moving and rehabbing that a little bit more. Generally speaking, you need about 6 weeks to start getting that ligament to start healing in. You want to keep range of motion going throughout, though, otherwise it will stiffen up on the, on you. From there, however, your rehab will go for another probably 6 to 8 weeks while you're trying to get your strength back up. And unfortunately, a lot of times it'd almost be easier if you'd broken something, because the rehab can feel a lot harder after a higher grade sprain with the amount of swelling that you have that continues. Everybody's always surprised when they come in at that 6 week or even the 8 or 10 week and they're still getting swelling in it. But we actually very much expect it to still have swelling. You have some degree of swelling up to a year out from your injury. Usually the first 3 to 6 months is the most noticeable and definitely expected.
So that's not like an old wives' tale, you know, that the, sometimes they tell you that, hey, you, this is going to take longer. If you had broken your ankle, it would probably be better. That's somewhat true.
As far as the type of pain that you have in general, people that break a bone, the broken bone actually feels better much more quickly or turns to more of an aching type pain. Whereas when somebody sprains their ankle and the amount of swelling you have and the amount of stiffness and scar, you know, scar tissue that you're getting from the ligaments trying to heal back in, people will have more of that tight feeling, the pulling sensation, and that tends to aggravate people longer than the broken bone. The actual time to return for strength is similar, but the stress that it puts on your feeling of normalcy is a bit different.
We have a couple of more minutes, and I can't, I definitely want to get to do this with you again, because I have so many questions, but I just have to, I have to read through some of this. Like I said before, Great Escape, Horse Recovery and Sanctuary. You like hiking in Patagonia. You like road trips across Brazil. You like train trips in Europe. You like to read. You like to go to trips at the family lake. You have such a wide variety of things. Do you still have time to get through all of those?
There's never enough time for everything I want to do. But I stay busy from essentially sun up, or actually usually before the sun comes up, particularly in the winter, until sundown, just taking care of getting everything in order, because we also have goats and chickens and, you know, guinea and everything else at home as well.
It is so fascinating, and I appreciate you coming on today. Hopefully you'll come back. I want to keep interviewing you, because every time I read about you, I want more. So once again, we've been talking to Dr. Leah Gunnell, Des Moines Orthopedic Foot and Ankle and Lower Extremity. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. It was nice talking to you as well.
Nice talking to you.
Here's a look at traffic on 101.3 and 1700, The Champ.
There's an accident on the left shoulder.
Can't wait to get to talk to her again. Fascinating young lady. I can say that because I'm old. I always thought I can't say young lady anymore, but I am. I'm old. So I can do that. While that was going on, if only you could have came in here and listened to the conversation that Randy Wehofer and I just had. It knocked my socks off, and I can't wait to start. So you are listening to Steen on Sports, bringing sports your way every day right here on 101.3 FM, 1700 The Champ AM, real sports talk for real sports fans. You can check us out on Twitter at 1700 The Champ, at Steen on Sports, and Facebook's at 1700 The Champ as well. I'm just going to get right into this. When I once again, general manager and
assistant
general manager VP for the Iowa Cubs.
Yeah, I don't want Sam listening.
And Sam knows me well enough to go, yeah, Steen just messed that up. I'm promoting Randy. He is coming in on Monday, so we can sit here and have discussions about baseball, which I could do all day long. And we didn't even talk about, I mean, I growing up, having a baseball card meant more to me than anything in the world. And the fact that my mom threw all my baseball cards away still haunts me to this day. But with that being said, I raised some topics with Randy, and once again, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And I appreciate you. I was supposed to type in 520 for my interview, and I typed in 5. It was totally my fault, and thank you for covering for me.
At least I'm on time today.
We did, because I want to get as much time with you as I can. The first thing I asked you, this is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I was going to lead it in one direction, and you actually brought it around to a different one to me. Just how difficult it is to play baseball, number one. We just had this discussion on there is such a small percentage of people that can play at a collegiate level, and then even a smaller percentage that can play in the minor leagues, and even a smaller percentage that can play in the major leagues. With all of that going on and the schedule that they do, 162 games, there's a lot of mental health awareness that needs to be out there. And it's something that we probably don't talk enough about, but I'm assuming that that's at some point that's on Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball management and ownership. It's on their minds.
Yeah, I think that's one of the ways the game has evolved in my career in Minor League Baseball. We talked about the evolution of coaching staff sizes and the amount of, you know, the number of players in professional baseball is being reduced as Major League Baseball has eliminated 20 affiliates from the minor league level. We're looking at reducing the draft. The current group of general managers and player development people feel like they have an idea of who, what skill set they need, and then what coaching they can provide. Minor League Baseball, when it was run by old former players, wanted it to be as hard as possible because that's the way it was when they came up, and that's the way it toughened you up in order to be able to survive in the big leagues. Now there's fewer players, but more is being invested in them than ever before. You've got strength and conditioning and nutrition and video and film study, and mental skills is one of the things that is part of this new program that's provided. Every team has a mental skills coordinator that deals with just your mindset, because baseball is a game of failure. It's the most cliche thing in the world to say about baseball is that the greatest in the world fail 7 out of every 10 times that they come to the plate. And it gets said so much that you lose the meaning in that sometimes. And what minor league baseball, the thing that stood out to me most when I started in this over 20 years ago was watching people fail at something for the first time in their life and how they overcame it. And that's really what separated the guys that moved on from A-ball and the ones that didn't. It wasn't physical ability. It was, I'm the guy that hit 600 in high school because the game is easy and I have great eye-hand coordination and all those kinds of things. Well, you still have all those things, but now you're facing pitchers who did things that they never did before, and you faced your first 0 for 10. And how did you come out on the other side of that? And they've decided that there's an investment to be made in having people surround players to deal with that in this era. And it allows the more naturally talented players probably more opportunities to understand the game and understand themselves rather than wash out a little sooner. And that's why we've got everybody throwing 95. You know, it used to be there was only one or two guys throwing 95. Do you really think the human body has changed all that much? Some, but half the guys who threw 95 that couldn't throw it over the plate didn't have a mental skills coordinator to help them understand how to harness some of that, as well as, you know, on the hitting side of things. So it is certainly something that Major League Baseball has prioritized in this new world of player development that we find ourselves in.
Last week, we talked about one of the things that you were struggling with the most was with new rules, depending on the amount of money that you made, finding housing for individuals that were playing for the iCubs. And I guess after what you just said, 10 years ago, was anybody making enough money that they would have had to pay for their own housing in AAA?
Probably. I mean, AAA has always been a mixed bag of guys who are coming back from injury, who have 5-6 years of major league time, who missed a year to Tommy John, there's lots of guys who are at 9.5 years of service time and just looking for 6 more months to get their full pension. And we're willing to spend some time in minor league baseball to find that next job. So AAA has always been a pretty wide variety of personal situations on that roster, and that probably will always remain.
The reasoning behind reducing the draft would be what?
They're putting more resources into the teams, so they have fewer places to play them.
Okay.
So they're investing more in housing and nutrition and sleep studies and strength and conditioning and facilities. You know, the facilities the Cubs built in Arizona with their weight room and their training room and all the things at their new spring training facility that they built 6 or 7 years ago now, that just like colleges are racing for facilities to get an edge in recruiting, major league teams are racing in facilities to attract free agents and to do different things. So, the less players means you can be more targeted in your approach. I think that the current general manager thinks that a less draft allows them to be more creative in free agency and use their acumen to spot players to be able to control more talent if they can sign more free agents rather than to have 50 rounds of players taken by all 30 teams. It's a lot of guys.
It is. Once again, we're talking to Randy Wehofer. Glad that you came back in. I just wrote down one that we kind of didn't talk a little bit about. 162 games in the major leagues. Do you think that's the right amount, or do you think it should be less? Can you figure out somebody that's good enough to win the World Series with less than 162 games?
I think you can, but I think the longevity of the baseball season is part of how you separate good and bad. I think it was that Fever Pitch movie with Jimmy Fallon and Drew Barrymore, ironically enough, that there was actually a poignant line in there. In baseball, you can't luck your – you can have a good week. You can even have a good month. It's hard to have a lucky year. The longevity and the staying power of what it takes to be a good team and a good player, I think, is part of what makes baseball unique. It is the everyday aspect. It is part of what I think is the most interesting part of the game, because as a husband and a father, as an employee, I got to be good in the morning after I've been up late at night. I've got to be good for doubleheaders. I've got to be attentive. When did your kids ever get sick? At 2 o'clock in the afternoon after you've had a nice meal and you were ready to give them their full attention. They always wake up in the middle of the night crying and,
yes,
and sick with a fever and you're not at your best, but they need you to be at your best. You know, in real life, we don't practice for 6 days, stay in a hotel on Saturday night and be really good for 3 hours on Sunday afternoon. That's just not how real life works. So I think the adaptability part of baseball I didn't handle that guy very well yesterday, but I've got another chance today to come right back and make up for that. It's not the biggest, fastest guy wins every time when you go to the playground and play pickup basketball. If you get dunked on by that guy on Tuesday, you're going to get dunked on by that guy on Wednesday, and you're going to get dunked on twice on Thursday. You know, you might go 0-for-4 against this guy on Tuesday and 3-for-4 against somebody else. That guy who's one for his last 10 sometimes gets the game-winning hit. That guy who's 8 for his last 9 sometimes strikes out with the bases loaded down a run. And the randomness is part of why the longevity of the season is necessary to determine who really deserves to be crowned in some sort of champion way, both individually and as a team. Now, is that 140 games instead of 162? Probably. But nobody wants to give away the money that they're making.
Right.
So is 20 less games worth it? And how do you fill that void? I think if we just embrace the process in all parts of the game, that kind of stuff would take care of itself.
Can Major League Baseball survive with all their teams and you have 10 that for whatever, your Cincinnati's right now, your Oakland's, which Oakland is actually playing well this season with a very small payroll. Can they survive with those 10 teams down here not spending very much and these 10 teams up here spending way more than everybody else and everybody in the middle? Is that a good mix? Is there something you can do about that mix, or you just let it happen?
I think there's always going to be ineptitude at the front office level, just like there's ineptitude on the field. So I don't think the payroll limitation, ask the Tampa Bay Rays over the last 5 years if their payroll has been a competitive disadvantage in the American League East. They are competing against the highest spenders in the industry, yet they've been to the World Series and won a championship and they don't keep their players, and that is frustrating to fans. They just need a better relationship with their municipality and get a stadium that would earn
them the biggest commensurate thing.
And the same with Oakland.
Yes.
You know, they have not developed their relationships in their community, and that is what is hamstringing their ability to bring in stars. It's not hamstringing your ability to put winning teams on the field, as Oakland and Tampa Bay have shown over the years. So is it easier? Yes. But Andrew Friedman left Tampa Bay to go be the general manager of the Dodgers because it's easier to write checks.
Right. And misses
rather than trade guys all the time.
A miss you can just kind of throw away. Mm-hmm. Where a miss in Oakland or Tampa Bay, it means something because, I still have to pay him and he's not giving me anything, where you can kind of write that off. And saying that with Oakland, it's really funny because even when they were really good, they still didn't have, they had a better following across the country than they actually did where they played. I was a huge Joe Rudy, one of my favorite players of all time. You look at Minnesota, I think going to Twins games is a lot of fun. I love going to Chicago. I like going to both sides of Chicago. I think both games the teams are fun. And when Chicago's good on both sides, it is so much fun there. New York's kind of the same way now as well. The funny thing to me is with Oakland, they made fun of Oakland preseason. Oh my gosh, they're getting rid of everybody. They're going to be horrible. And they're at 500. Now, there's other teams that traded away a lot of people that aren't playing well. I think it just gives us something to talk about. I agree with you that I don't think it really matters. It's still the game. And I love the fact, for the love of the game. That's always my comeback when people ask me about baseball. If you don't love the game of baseball, there's nothing baseball can do to make you love the game. We loved it when Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire were doing what they were doing and everybody knew they were cheating. But we loved it, and it was on TV every night. They cut into TV programs. They cut into TV programs with Barry Bonds. Same thing. That love goes away quickly. And it did go away quickly.
Well, I think baseball fans are really selfish, and it's been like that.
I like that.
Forever.
That's a good word.
Baseball is the one game where my generation is always better than your generation. The way I remember it is always better than the way it is now, and we fight about this constantly. As a teenager into a young adult, and then I watch Ken Griffey Jr., I cannot imagine that Mickey Mantle was appreciably better in any one way, but you lose the magic when you turn a certain age as to what those players represent. And for some reason, we're resentful when we get older of letting young kids have that same mystique and imagination for the players of their generation. And I don't know why we do that. as people that say we love the game. It's silly. Football and basketball don't do that.
No.
Every next generation, this is the greatest player. Every generation has the new greatest player of all time. We are constantly crowning a new GOAT in every other thing, but we can't get off of Babe Ruth in baseball and adorn anybody else. So baseball needs to do, and I made this comment to you before, baseball has lost a voice nationally to give perspective in the mainstream. Our mainstream media is dominated by former NFL and NBA players, and for some reason, former Major League Baseball players don't go into that life, or they only do it on the MLB Network, where you don't get anybody but diehard baseball fans watching. If somebody was speaking about the game on a level that wasn't overreacting day to day, which is what most of this medium is, and I appreciate the fact that you do it a little bit differently and enjoy talking to you about it, that we have lost that perspective of 0-for-14 doesn't define that guy. That guy doesn't stink all of a sudden. He's not good in this moment, but he has not forgotten how to be a good hitter. Giving up 9 runs in 3 innings and getting shelled in a loss does not mean a pitcher has forgotten how to be good. We have forgotten all the great pitchers that had those games from time to time on both sides. So the beauty of the game is the randomness and the longevity. It's why it's different, and we don't embrace that as a baseball public. And that's what I hope, as a steward of the game and my position with the Iowa Cubs and my time as a broadcaster, that I just tell you why I like it. And you can agree with me or disagree with me, but it comes from an authentic place. And the game has survived a lot. World wars, pandemics, it will survive all of this. My greatest complaint about Major League Baseball currently is that everybody's trying to do it the same way, and it's less interesting.
Absolutely.
We have lost the teams that the struggle of the fast teams that steal bases on AstroTurf and bunt against the teams that swing for the fences, and everybody has the same roster composition, and it makes it less interesting because it feels more repetitive. And I hope that what most people misunderstand about Moneyball is it wasn't about on-base percentage, it was about market inefficiency. And what the A's and the Rays have done is identify what stats are being overpaid for, but what other stats are being underpaid, and then going and signing those guys because you build winning teams differently than the way other teams are winning. Everybody's copycatting everyone else with the shifts and all the other things, and that's why they have a PR problem. If we could get someone to have the guts to try to win a different way, the game would correct itself, in my opinion.
This went too fast. I can't wait till next week. I enjoy having you in here and talking baseball, my friend.
Likewise.
Thank you very much. Randy Wehofer, everybody. You're listening to Steen on Sports. I'll be back right after this commercial break.
Sports 1700, the champ. Real sports talk for real sports fans.
Welcome back in, everybody. Sorry about that. I was trying to get a hold of Maddie Nelson. Hopefully, Maddie will try to give me a quick call at 515-264-1700, and I will get him on here. What a great segment with Randy Wehofer. See, here's one of the bad things, right? So I get so excited when Randy comes in here because I love talking baseball. I didn't grow up an NBA fan. I didn't grow up a college basketball fan. I didn't grow up being a pro football fan. I grew up being a baseball fan because you could listen to it on the radio and you could do all these things. And I was telling Randy that one of the biggest things during baseball season, one of my best friends, Brian Spohr, he was a St. Louis Cardinal fan. I don't even know if he was a St. Louis Cardinal fan, but he was an Ozzie Smith fan. And I loved Ozzie Smith too, but not as much because he did. So I'm like, okay, if we're going to have this fight and this discussion, I've got to find somebody that I like, and I'm going to find somebody that fits what I think they should be. So I was a Robin Yount fan. So I had Milwaukee Brewers and the St. Louis Cardinals. We fought every day during baseball season on who was the best, why they were the best, everything about it. We fought. And it was the greatest thing ever. And I don't think I enjoyed enough, because I don't get to talk to Brian as much. He's down in Florida, and I don't get to talk to him as much. It was, I missed that. I miss having that conversation. And I mean, we're talking about it off air and we're talking about it on air. So next week, when Randy comes in on Monday, we're going to have the first segment. We're going to talk about iCubs and all the things that are going on. And then we're going to have the second, he's going to stay for a second segment, and we're going to talk about baseball. Because I think, not that it's great radio, because I think Randy and I agree more on what's right and what's wrong with baseball, but I have all these questions, and I had a whole bunch today, and we didn't get through all of them. I think one of the things that I wanted to talk about today, and if Maddie doesn't, I'll try to get Maddie to come in the next day, tomorrow. This is Mental Health Awareness Month. We're in the second day of May. I need my audience to understand that it, even though it probably takes more than a month to explain all the things that attribute to your mental health. I read today that, and I'm gonna pull it up here in just a second. And I'll keep talking while I'll try. I'm trying to do two things at once. Like that's easy for me to do. It is so difficult to understand on a mental health level where everybody's at on a daily basis. You can't look at somebody and figure out if they have a mental health issue. Probably the exact opposite. Some people that you think may have mental health issues don't, and people that you think don't probably do. There's no good way to recognize it. There just isn't. There's just no good way of doing any of that. It just doesn't. It doesn't happen. And there's so much of it that's going on now. We have lost in a short amount of time, and we've talked about this a couple of times in the past few weeks. We've lost three athletes in women's sports, collegiate sports, in less than a month. And it's very, it's disheartening, because you don't know. Oh, here we go. I'm going to hold that thought. I'm going to hit that, and I'm going to hit that. Maddie Nelson, are you there?
I am there. We had a screaming kid, but we're all good now, Steve.
It wasn't Charlotte, was it?
It was Charlotte. She's kind of sleepy.
Oh, Charlotte. What cute pictures, by the way. I am there is not a greater day as a parent than to be baptized, my friend. That was so awesome. And congratulations.
Yes. Well, thank you. And my apologies again for running a little late today. But we had a great weekend and a great time with family. Lots of Cyclone sports discussed and among other things. So all in all, it was a joyous weekend.
Well, let's jump into that really quick, and we'll do this as we got about 5-6 minutes left. I think from everything that happened, yes, we didn't get another number one, get a pick in the first round. I don't care, Matt. That's the least. The fact that we had as many of our athletes be able to get into football training camp and win a spot, Matt Campbell has to be excited. The university has to be excited. You have to be excited because I know I'm excited.
I was. I mean, four picks is a big deal. There were years not all that long ago, Steve, where we didn't know if Iowa State would get any every single year. And if you did pick up one, it was a sixth-round pick. To have guys like Chase Allen not even get drafted, which was probably one of those scenarios where it's either, you know, you turn down being a late-round pick to be a free agent because you can choose your destination. It's impressive. Actually, you know, any Uwazu Rike went a little higher than I think people expected, but he's a great player, so nobody should be surprised by that. And all it made for a fun draft. I think everyone should be proud of what this staff has done, but it also, you know, it bodes well for this program in the future that they can churn out NFL players like this.
I agree. Not to put all sugarcoating, Iowa State have a issue with defensive backs right now on campus?
great question. That's a common one that's been asked by a lot of people. You know, there could be something with the coaching staff. To be honest, through the channels that I've heard, I don't necessarily think that it is a coaching problem. I think some of this comes down to playing time. Younger players in the secondary that are going to get bigger minutes. You just saw a junior college safety committed here over the weekend. I don't think any of that timing is inconsequential. I do think it's probably just more indicative of where things are headed for college football, where depth is kind of imaginary. And if you saw the reaction from some of the players on social media to some of these transfer announcements, it almost had a vibe of good riddance. So I think you could probably safely assume that some of this was NIL money related.
We have so much we need to talk about, and I'll even shoot you a note, and we'll try to figure out to get some more time. Let's talk about, if I had these last 2 minutes, if I had to talk about something that has me so excited, this is the place I'm going. I don't know what's going on, but Coach Bill Finley and his staff have it going on, Matthew.
Oh, they do. Unbelievable. You know, you had Jamie Pollard kind of admit in an interview last week that the grad transfer they got, who is going to be a game-changing player, was sought after by Texas and a lot of other really big schools. And I wouldn't pay any attention to, you know, any attrition that happens in this program, because again, I think it is all related to playing time. And quite frankly, Bill continues to recruit at almost an absurdly high level, and especially at the forward position, which anybody who has watched women's basketball more than casually over the last 5 years knows that that has been an issue. Having size to be able to compete with teams like Baylor down low is something that they're going to have to get better at. And they've definitely addressed that this offseason.
The Jones girl going to Jenny Bronchek makes perfect sense to me as well.
It does. It hurts a little bit, not going to lie, as a Cyclones fan.
It does.
I think that's just purely playing time. I don't think it has any impact on the relationships that family has with this program. But look, Denarski and Emily Ryan eat up a lot of playing time.
Absolutely, and as well they should.
I think that's why Kylie Furbach transferred out of the program as well. Just there's only so many minutes when you can only start five players.
And I got to tell you that with Iowa State where it is and where Iowa is where they are and where you and I is and where Drake is with the women's basketball, those are four of the highest quality teams in one state that I think you can find across this country.
Agreed. And it just this region in general, right? You've got a Creighton squad that upset Iowa in the tournament. This region is just turning out some top-notch women's basketball prospects, and I'm glad a lot of them are staying close to home.
I am too. Maddie, I'll give you a jingle. I'll get you back in here. Thanks for calling in. Tell Charlotte I said hello.
Will do, Steve. We'll talk later.
All right, buddy. Maddie Nelson, Charlotte, gotta love him. Listening to Steen on Sports, I will see you tomorrow.